Welcome to the Big Muse podcast. Today I'm sitting in the home of a person. His name is Jim Cohen, and I'm trying to explain, you know, who he is and who he is to me. He doesn't fit a lot of mold, that's for sure. Well, let me start by saying, when people ask me what I think about LinkedIn, you might know LinkedIn. It's like a business online thing. You get acquainted with people. And a lot of people have different thoughts about LinkedIn. It's, you know, they don't know how to use it, or it's something that just sits there.
Yeah.
For me, LinkedIn always resonates as a real thing. It's a virtual connector that connected me with Jim. I think, I don't know how I friended him on LinkedIn, or he friended me or something. And what happens with these things, if it really goes someplace, you actually meet. You have to meet in the flesh. You have to leave the digital domain. And we spoke first on the phone. I'm like, this guy is smart. I can learn something from him. And then we met in Chicago where he lives. And Jim has been, I would say, an incredible friend to me. And he's also been a mentor. He's taught me a lot of things. Some of those things we'll hear about hopefully today. And another thing about Jim, before I explain what he does, I'd like to explain who he is rather than exactly what he does. Jim has just been through a very, very challenging health issue. And when I say challenging, that's challenging with a capital C, to the extent that I wondered literally if I'd ever see this guy again. And maybe he'll talk about that too. The difference between being in good health and taking it for granted and having gone through that experience and what that brings to a person's life. He told me this morning, he's just like in that spirit of renewal somehow. Jim has been, I guess, an architect, a designer. He's done so many things. What he does, and it's a little bit difficult to explain, he helps companies in transitions. He helps them look at what it is they do for people. Some people want him to brand their company. And he says, you can't just brand yourself. You have to understand deeply and intrinsically what it is that you do. You can't just put a name on something. You have to answer a lot of questions. So before we get into the health stuff, help me out here and explain, you know, for people, you have a very unique job. It's not common. It's not like you're frying French fries or driving a cab or selling insurance. How would you explain what it is that you do?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Peter. So to get to the crux of it all, what I do is help businesses and individuals understand what they stand for. I started talking with all of these groups of people years ago about soul. And coming from the position of being both an artist and a musician and kind of a student of life, I felt it important for businesses to understand what they stood for early in the game, before they start designing things, before they start making things, before they start hiring communications people. The question for me was, what are you trying to communicate? And so my career path was that for the first 20 years, I was in the architectural interior design business, where I was a partner in a big firm. And aside from all that stuff, we spent a tremendous amount of time talking with CEOs of major businesses about what they stood for, what their plans were, what their culture was about, how you plan to house your people over time, what are your goals for your business. And unless they were real understandable differentiating characteristics, it was really hard to do a good job for them. And so if you fast forward about 20 years, I got out of that business and into what I do today, which is helping businesses understand this stuff without the architectural interior design part necessarily, I felt it important to dig deep. So a lot of the work I do, which could be called brand work in its truest sense, is revealing for businesses and individuals what you stand for. What are you willing to put it all on the line for? We used to say, what are you willing to crawl over broken glass for? And the understanding of that, kind of coupled with the opportunities out there in the world, begin to define your business, your purpose, and how you can be successful, how you can be differentiated. And that's what I do. So there's a lot of words for this. Some people call it design thinking. There's a lot of empathy for the human condition in the work that we do. And the results turn out to be environments, service models, more tangible communications vehicles, and I think a great learning for the people involved. You know, like everybody that we participate with in the process gets something out of it that's more than the standard deliverable. It's kind of a life learning that we think is important.
No, I was just gonna maybe speak on behalf of some listeners here, and this is, you know, I was new to this too when you introduced to me.
Yeah.
This whole idea, the first thing I thought of, cynic that I am, was like, look, is this just something that you're tagging on to people to assuage their guilt? Because really what businesses want to do is just make a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and is it really effective? Let's just say, maybe you could give an example of a culture, the value of a culture, for example.
Yeah.
You know, give me a concrete example of a company that's successful that has a very well-defined cultural value.
Sure, sure. So, you know, this has become increasingly important, and I'll go back a bit and then forwards a bit. In the early 90s, I was living in Seattle, and through a magical moment, I was in a meeting and somebody said, you really need to meet Howard Schultz, who is the CEO of Starbucks. And so within 2 weeks, I found myself sitting in Howard's office and talking about very similar things. And if you look at the growth of Starbucks from at the time that I met them, you know, a couple of $100 million to, I believe, up to $16 billion now in gross revenue, aside from driving revenue and creating a tremendous amount of wealth for the business and for the stockholders, there's a set of core beliefs and values that they hold true to. And they're quite simple. I think that Howard as an individual and his team then, which included Howard Bihar, really believed in the power of each person that worked for them and the dignity of those people. And to give, you know, they had a responsibility as a business to give them more than they expected. And in so doing, those people that were team members at Starbucks would give back to the consumer an incredible experience. So they valued this, and they were the first employer in this sort of fast casual food business to provide their workers with part-time workers with healthcare insurance. Mm. And healthcare insurance made a tremendous difference to these people, was a differentiator, and kept them involved in the business in new ways. It also attracted to the company very interesting kinds of people who couldn't get healthcare insurance and wanted to work part-time, like artists and musicians and actors. And so now your staff is a very eclectic, interesting group who are perhaps more extroverted than the norm. And what does that mean to the consumer experience as you, a consumer, walks towards them every day? And so the benefit to the business is you have a great empowered workforce. You're giving them things they didn't expect, and they're giving back to the consumer things they never expected. To date, you know, the latest move amongst others were giving free college tuition to every employee without regard even if they would stay with the organization. Mm. So these are very generous moves on behalf of a business that come from a set of core values and beliefs that turn into mechanisms to grow the business and keep people satisfied. So, I mean, that's real. And I think you could point to Apple for similar reasons. I think you could point to Google for similar reasons. And lots of new models of business that have these kinds of things that are capitalistic, grow the business, grow top line, grow bottom line, but give back more than you expected.
Is it new? For example, General Motors in the 50s. I mean, is this something that they would have not understood?
Yeah. I mean, I think generally entrepreneurial founding people, founding fathers of businesses get this. I think that with growth, it washes away at times if the leader who had these values is diminished in some way or shape or form. And if I point back to Starbucks, I think, you know, Howard Schultz at the helm is a very important thing for that business because he is an embodiment of these ideals. The organization needs to point to this person and say, that person is who I aspire to be, because they are truly an embodiment of the ideal. It isn't just talk, they actually show it in their actions. And that, again, is a great move in business. So we spend a lot of time trying to find out what that stuff is and empower leadership again to become that more fully, more actively, more demonstratively to help them drive a bigger business. Ultimately, the goal might be to make more money, but to make more money in this business environment, you have to be legit, you have to be real, and you have to deliver.
Right. I mean, I asked you to articulate this, not because I needed convincing.
Yeah.
And I needed convincing at one time.
Yeah.
And this, when I mentioned the mentorship that you offered me.
Yeah.
I will say that this was a novel idea to me. First of all, I'd never heard of anything like it. I don't think I had any interest or concern in it. My first thought was, this is just sounds like almost some new age.
Yeah.
Something that somebody's applying to business to kind of sweeten it and make it appear as something other than just a money grubbing existence. But I've since come to the understanding, and much of the work that I do on Big Muse is really stems from things that you taught me about this purpose. And I also think things that are true in business, we happen to be talking about business now, but they're also true in certainly in personal relationships. You know, who are we together? What do we stand for?
Right.
What do I as an individual stand for in this relationship? What are the things I won't do? How do I engender integrity and trust? And, you know, those are universals. And when I came to understand this idea that it's everywhere, it's ubiquitous, it's in music as well. We talked a little bit at lunch today about, you know, about Prince, that aside from his musicality, aside from his just indescribable genius as a musician, he also had a vision for how things should be. He carried with him, it's hard to really articulate what the particulars of his vision, but he was strong-willed. He had a sense of how the world should be.
Mm-hmm.
And he evinced that through his music and through all the sort of the acolytes that spun out through him. And what you're really talking about in a certain way, it becomes a trope and a meme to even use this word, leadership. But you just hear it bandied about. It's such a sickening word. But at the heart of it, as a parent, as a father, requires leadership. As a friend, I mean, it's not just something that you apply to professional leaders like politicians or corporate leaders. And once I understood from you that this truth of knowing what you stand for and meeting it out and evincing it in every corner of your life, it's true, and it needs to, any truth, I believe, needs to apply in every situation. Otherwise, it's just a sort of partial or compartmentalized truth, which negates its truthfulness altogether. Tell me a little bit, I mentioned at the beginning that you have this health challenge. I mean, we don't have to go into all the details of the medical side, but, you know, suffice it to say, it was very serious. I was, you know, in California, and I try to keep in contact with you. I was really worried that I'd never see you again. You've emerged from it. Tell us a little bit about what you see in this emergent state of mind.
Yeah, well, thank you. And thanks to you as well. So I'm in this place of having emerged from, as Peter said, being really sick, and sicker than I ever imagined I would ever be, with something that I didn't really understand anything about going into it, and it hit me like a lead weight in the middle of the night while I was on the road working with clients, and somehow got back to Chicago. And, you know, I was in the hospital for about 5 weeks, and a bunch of times it was pretty dire. And I'm in that state of feeling like I've been sprung from prison, you know, for about 5 months of recovery and haven't experienced the world much. So everything looks new, bright, and shiny, tempered with deep learning that's almost hard to describe. But I can tell you that because I was so ill and so unprepared for being so ill, I kind of woke up one morning in the early stages of this and said to my wife, you know, we have to survive somehow through this emotionally, physically, financially, in ways that we never considered. And I probably don't need to go into, for many of you, how expensive that much treatment in a hospital can be, but it could bankrupt anybody. So we came up with this notion of living on love. You know, it's interesting to me as a parallel to the work I do with people about these core beliefs. Like, you really have to believe in something if you're going to get through this. And for me, it was visualizing what it would look like if I was well again, even though there were times where I never thought I'd get there. And I had this little moment of feeling like and this happened in the winter, that I wanted to be back in the sun. And if I could just get back in the sun, somehow I would be okay. And so we put our faith in ourselves and the people around us. And sure enough, all of a sudden the hospital room was full of people just wanting to be next to us and to help us in any way that we needed, without barring anything. And my friends and family surpassed even my wildest dreams of their level of love and care and support, in amazing ways, and pretty much kept me alive emotionally. And the other side of it is something that we don't talk about a lot, which was, you know, like, how are you supposed to be when you're that sick as a patient? And if I applied the same values, one of the things that I did repeatedly was be grateful and thankful to the people that were taking care of me, who, again, like my friends and family, surpassed my wildest dreams or understandings of what healthcare professionals could be, to keep you, literally to keep you alive, to keep you clean, to keep you motivated, and I tried to keep them motivated. And ultimately, these people all pulled together to save me. And ultimately, my body saved me by healing. That's been the amazing journey. And the learnings are about love as being a huge driver for what could be. And the emotional fortitude that it took for me to believe that I would heal, even when intellectually it felt like things were going off the rails. And ultimately I did. So life looks fresh and new and bright, and all of this information will somehow seep back into the work I do with people with a very deep and quite visceral learning.
If you had to write a note to yourself, something that would be like a little time capsule of this bright and shiny moment, to sort of preserve it for yourself, because, you know, these things, no matter what they are, they do tend to drift away. I mean, after somebody passes away, and it's just like, you know, I'll never forget this, I'll be totally changed, and at the birth of a child, I mean, there are these moments that cause you to wake up, mm-hmm. but in fact, because we're just human, they fade away.
Right.
And so if you had to write a little message to yourself in 5 years, just to you know, possibly interdict some mm-hmm. feelings that, you know, you're just living a mundane existence in the future, what might you say to yourself
at this time? Yeah, that's a great question. You know, what comes to mind immediately is life is remarkable. And when I say life, it's kind of everything wrapped up into the being aliveness. The fact that your body can be put through amazingly challenging procedures and illness and have, you know, and refresh itself and be alive again is amazing. And the fact that we gloss over so many little things in life, we walk by them. We fail to recognize the hurt as well as the happiness that's occurring out there in the world in ways where you really do have to pause. And, you know, it's easy to say, you know, stop and smell the roses. But the truth is, we don't do that enough. And in these moments where life looks bright and shiny again, it's important to remember that this is a tremendously intricate experience that we're living, both externally and internally, and we should remember that, you know. With all the medical help in the world that I got, ultimately it was at a cellular level, my cells had to, like, go wake up again and find each other, and they did. It's
talk quite, to each, start the conversation.
Yeah, come again. On now, y'all, let's, like, play ball again, and they did. So the recovery has been amazing, and I still have a bit to go. But it is a remarkable experience.
And in what way has this altered, you know, you talked about values and what you stand for. And in what way has this experience changed those values?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's changed them. I think it might have heightened them. I was always kind of, you know, somebody that loved to live life and was deeply curious. The curiosity kept me going through this process because a lot of it was highly scientific, and I had teams of doctors working on it that felt like designers that I'm very used to working with, and, you know, innovation consultants that I'm quite used to working with, who were exploring, you know, open avenues and blind alleys, and at the same time, and not finding any conflict in that. And I had to be kind of the client saying, okay, I hear what you're saying, but could we avoid taking my arm off today, or, you know, things like that. And so it heightened what I'm about, and it gave it deepened perspective, but it didn't change my values. And it's sort of like, well, so that's how I know they are my values, because they wouldn't budge.
Now, not to put you on the spot or anything, but do you have a means of sort of succinctly articulating what the values are? I mean, are they something that's at the tip of your tongue?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, and if I was judging me now as the way I do clients, I'd probably say you need to go deeper. But there's something deeply enmeshed in me about empathy, you know, care of the human spirit in myself and others, creativity, in all forms, because I was raised as an artist and became a musician for a while and ended up as a designer. And I think that's important. And being deeply curious, like, how do things work? And ironically, because of the work that I did in architecture and architectural interiors and the work I do today, I'm kind of possessed by how things work from the inside out. Like, you know, this whole notion of what do you stand for? How do you wire that up with mechanisms that keep you in integrity and generate this stuff are internal, as opposed to, you know, kind of judging what the consumer is up to. That's important, but we're more interested in where you come from.
Now, sometimes when I am doing this work that you had mentored me to do with different companies, I always want to, at this point, take them up the chain. I want to ask your opinion on this.
Yeah.
For me, going up the chain, or I use the word up, use the word deeper, it's up and down,
but yeah,
we don't know where it is directionally. I'm always interested to know that the values that we espouse, there's a purpose to them.
Yeah.
So the word purpose and value somehow coexist. In other words, for me, and this is my opinion, I'd like to get your opinion on that too, deeper or higher up the chain, however you look at it, to me, always means, well, what does this do in terms of generosity for others?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the curiosity. I would ask a nudgy question like, so you're curious, and what is the end result of this curiosity in terms of it being a gift to someone, including yourself and others? I always include oneself in the peoplehood. But how would you speak to this idea of the curiosity? What is it? What are you bringing to the world through that curiosity?
Yeah.
And do you believe that in fact is a higher or deeper articulation of this value?
Yeah, I think it's more about how you play it out in life,
like how it's manifested.
Right, how it's manifested. And so, for me, I am deeply curious. I'm reading things. I'm going places. I'm listening to things all the time.
Yes.
And what I try to do is things that are simple. Like, I'm sitting here with a food magazine in front of me, so it's sort of tickling me thing. But I'm constantly looking at stuff like that and then thinking, so what could we make for dinner for the people that we love that comes out of the magazine that I'm so curious about that I never tried to do before? This is a simple gesture. And it's a lost gesture in many homes these days of bringing people around the table and serving them food that you made.
Right.
With your heart and with your hands, as a meal. And in that meal, we get to talk about interesting topics and we bring people together and we show them that we love and care. So it's sort of curiosity that turns into a mechanism that generates an outcome.
Yeah.
And on the business side, the leaps that I think are important to make are from values and purpose, let's say, is to directives and principles. So if you believe this stuff and we have insights about you, what direction or what directives do you need to turn those ideas, those values, into something more tangible that the world can see that you stand for?
See, this is what I really loved about the way that you taught me about this. In simple terms, I think you once used an example of some hospital that you're working with, and it had something to do with design and architecture.
Yep.
So their whole thing was about caring and this and that. And you asked, so how do these plans for these new architectural designs for a new, how do they evince these ideas? Because I don't see it.
Right.
It just looks like some, in other words, the beauty of your description of, you know, having the curiosity reading this food magazine, the fact that it's manifested in a meal for people, that to me is a great example. And you can scale it up or down, it doesn't matter. This is small, but it contains all the kernels of truth. If it became, you know, a $25 million hospital somewhere as well, how does the purpose, how do the values, you know, how does the rubber meet the road? And that really is always got to be the question. And you, if you can't find it at the highest level, sometimes you hide behind, not you, but one hides behind, you know, platitudes and we're going to, no, I really need to know exactly how this is working on a practical level?
Right.
Can you break it down to small pieces? Can you show me specifically what this is doing? And if you can't, you know, I don't think the connection has fully been made.
Right.
And I ask this sometimes of young musicians who come to me for some mentorship. And I ask them, you know, probably a really annoying question. You know, I'm not going to talk necessarily about chord progressions right away or anything, or recording techniques. What is your purpose on stage?
Right.
What is it that you're trying to do? And you could be very honest. For many years, I think part of my purpose was just was self-aggrandizement. Look at me. I need your love. And to a great extent, that still exists to me. But I do think there's got to be something, if you're looking to be successful or to have an engaged and happy life, there has to be something that fans out to other people.
Right.
And I force them to come up with one sentence, you know, it could be a long sentence, it could be a run-on sentence, but I want to know what it is that you're doing, for example, on stage.
Right.
And for them, the exercise of articulating it and making it slim and clean is powerful. You can always refine it.
Right.
But I suggest, you know, you write those things down in any case, whatever it is that you're doing, what is my family? What is my purpose for raising a family? You know, and write it down somewhere. You don't have to share it with the world, but it's important that I think that we, each of us, understands this very depthful part of the way we move through the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that this is not something that I thought about much before I met you.
Mm.
You really had a profound influence, you know, on all these things that I think about. So when you got sick, I was particularly upset. You know, it was like, this guy's got to make it.
Mm.
I got to get more of this Jim Cohn stuff.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I did. The little thing that I would add to this is that it is sort of a little thing. In other words, in life or even in business, you can make bold moves or you could make subtle moves. They have equal value. And sometimes it's just a subtle shift of the light that gives you increased value. You have to be real from this place. And I think when it gets overly complicated and turns into a big song and dance, and then, you know, it's like the mechanism has taken over the value.
Right, you're creating some obfuscating force.
Simple gestures seem to be incredibly powerful. And I would kind of echo it back to what's happened to me recently. I really didn't know consciously the impression I was making on others I was doing my life. And I've had a lot of time to do it. When I needed the help of others, they showed up without question because they said, you always did. And I thought, well, I would never really thought about that. You know, I was just doing my life. So coming from this place of where you stand, and you can call it values, you can call it purpose, but actually demonstrating that in small ways over a convincing period of time reaps tremendous benefit and gives you not just the edge, but gives you the authenticity, the realness to overcome a lot of adversity.
Yeah, I think of it in terms of resilience.
Yeah.
You know, because our lives are so full of judgment and they're so full of no's, you know, to negativity from within primarily and from without. And for me, this idea of, well, what do you stand for? It's made me a lot stronger to deal with those things, because it's not all about me anymore. This needs to be done for somebody else, and I can count and call on specific things that need to get done. People are a lot, you know, more generous than we give ourselves credit for. We don't give ourselves as much as we like to give to others sometimes.
Yeah.
We're a call to action for somebody else is something we might, you know, listen to.
Yeah.
So that, my friends, is a little sample of Jim Cohen. I'm sitting here looking out over sunny Chicago, his verdant apartment. It's all trees. We're on the fourth floor. So we see green all around.
It's green. It's sunny.
And well, thank you for coming and, you know, being a part of this, Jim, and the whole deal. And thank you for listening. We'll be back soon.